Hi, this is Paul, and this is Rough Draft for Sunday, when I go through the current status of my Sunday sermon. Quite recently, a poll was done with some good news. The good news is that Americans are more united than they've been for the last little while. The bad news is that they are united on thinking things aren't going very well at all. That's been 2020 for you. I ran across a great quote from Dr. King from a 1957 sermon. Somehow the isness of our present nature is out of harmony with the eternal oughtness that forever confronts us. And I thought that was a pretty good line, a pretty good way of understanding where we are right now. There's a lot of feeling that the isness is not anywhere near in harmony with the oughtness that is always confronting us. Now, proposed solutions for such things are predictable, as we've talked about for the last few weeks. Brett Weinstein, I mentioned him. He was in a video about Game B, and it was this whole really smart people trying to figure out a way to change the world and save it in a new direction. And then just last week, he was on Fox News telling everybody about his United 2020 scheme that would have a presidential ticket with a person from the moderate left and one from the moderate right. And actually, in some ways, it mirrors something of the first scheme of American presidents, where you'd have the winner taking the president position and the number two person taking the vice president position. But that was abandoned pretty early on. But what struck me about the idea was it's really sort of more of the same, where you become powerful. And in the ancient world, you would do that by killing the new leader and replacing him. In the modern world, it's more like develop fame and reputation and ride that in. And once you're in power, use the rule of law or force or something to push your good ideas on everyone else. That doesn't seem to me terribly different from any other arrangement we have today. Now, certainly the people on top may be better or worse, but there's seldom a lot of agreement as to whether or not the people on top are good or bad. When I look at these aspiring world changers, I notice that the projects almost always break down for predictable reasons. I mentioned this a couple of weeks ago, and in this Game B video, the project broke down because the people even within the project, all of these very smart people, and I'm sure they're very smart, and I'm sure they're very well-meaning, and they want to save the world, and they want the best for the world, but the basic disagreement of do you start with individuals first or do you fix institutions first, they divided on that and on a few other aspects, and the whole project broke down. And as I mentioned a couple weeks ago, I would recommend looking at Jesus. Jesus is the most successful world changer that the world has ever known. And he didn't do it with an army, and he didn't do it with a government, and he didn't even write a book. He poured 3 years, only 3 years, that's less than a presidential term, into 12 disciples plus a group of followers anywhere from 75 to 120. And in fact, when he was killed, he was sufficiently unpopular to be hated enough by both sides of a vicious culture war so that the only thing that these political rivals could agree on was that the world was better without Jesus. Now, this, of course, is a very old story, and it's been around a long time, but it continues to gain fresh admiration. Tom Holland, whose book cover I use for a lot of my sermons, in case you haven't noticed, began to be amazed by this as a historian of the ancient world, that someone who died the death of a slave was cast as the maker and master of the world. And he said, imagine you've got to write a story in which for the first time, somebody who suffered the excruciating death of a slave is going to be cast as being in some way part of the creator God who fashioned everything, and he's got to be convincing, not just for the people now, not just for the 2012 or 2016 or 2020 election cycle, but for 2,000 years and span the whole world, all the different cultures, horizontally and vertically. And you've got to make him compelling. It's a really astonishing thing to have pulled off as a literary feat, and that four people did it is amazing. And again, the fact that four people did it within a span of a decade or two emphasizes the fact that, well, you don't find four Shakespeares all in one place, but here, four relatively nobodies did it about one individual. And you might say, well, what, okay, but I'm a nobody. I'm never going to run for president. I'm never going to be wealthy. I'm never going to be famous. I'm never going to be popular. Okay, Pastor, speak for yourself. Okay, I'm never going to be famous or popular or wealthy. I mean, I've got a birthday coming up in July. I'm not getting any younger. And so, you know, it could be that I've peaked at this point. So where do you begin? Well, the disciples had to begin someplace. But then again, we face the fact that our isness remains out of harmony with the oughtness that confronts us. And for the most part, you get two or three people together and we can't even agree on what that means. We don't have political status. We don't have political power. We don't have fame. We don't have popularity. We don't have military strength. We don't have wealth. Well, why not begin at home? Why not begin with yourself? We've been looking at the Sermon on the Mount, and Jesus' sermon is remarkably scalable. On one hand, the greatest philosophers and theologians of the world have been reading it, and it continues to defy easy summation. Yet when you take a look at the kinds of things, kind of his best, his greatest hits here, they're remarkably relatable, can be taken enormously personal, and yet are scalable to even families and nations sometimes. And so a few weeks ago when we started this, we took a look at the structure of the Sermon on the Mount and noted that for as difficult a time that we have in sort of framing this thing and reducing it to something we can sort of get our hands on and wield, at the center of it is the most simple thing of all. It's a simple prayer that millions of Christians have memorized and said over and over and over again. And as we've done in the last number of weeks, if you're confused or frustrated or worried, start here. But now Jesus doesn't leave us there. That prayer is nested in these three admonitions. Be careful not to practice your righteousness in front of others to be seen by them. If you do so, you will have no reward from your Father in heaven. And this we've heard repeated for the last 3 weeks. So when you give to the needy, do not announce it with trumpets as the hypocrites do in the synagogue to be honored by others. Truly, I tell you, they have received their reward in full. But when you give to the needy, do not let your left hand know what your right hand is doing. And again, so memorable. You might not even be able to say where you got the idea from. Millions of people probably don't know it even comes from the Bible, but it's right there from Jesus. So do your giving in secret. And then this punchline, which will be repeated basically 3 times, then your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. And the same thing about prayer. When you pray, don't babble, don't repeat. It's not like putting coins in a slot machine. Your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. So, don't do it for others to see. Close the door of your room, do it quietly, pray to your Father who is unseen. Then your Father who sees what is done in secret will reward you. And now fasting. When you fast, do not look somber as the hypocrites do, for they disfigure their faces to show others they are fasting. Truly, I tell you, they have received their reward in full. But when you fast, put oil on your head and wash your face. In a sense, he's saying, you know, make yourself up, just like you normally do for public appearance, so it will not be obvious to others that you are fasting, but only to your Father, who is unseen. Have you seen this again? Again and again. It's repeated, isn't it? And your Father, who sees what is done in secret, will reward you. don't know how Jesus could make the point any more clearly about the moral show. Three times, three identical language, three pillars of what public righteousness meant for the religious context of his day. Giving away your money, prayer, fasting. And, of course, did he live it? Well, look at how he died. There was even an Old Testament verse that made that point. He himself will be killed in the most humiliating way that was supposed to make a political and a moral point. And you can find in the book of Deuteronomy, which the Apostle Paul brings out on numerous occasions in his epistle, this thing. If someone is guilty of a capital offense, was Jesus guilty of that? Is put to death and their body is exposed on a pole, often the translation is a tree, but everybody understood impaling in the ancient world, and Romans had a particular version of it. They didn't impale you on the pole, they kept you on the front of the cross so your dying could be slow and humiliating. They perfected the art of the public execution. Be sure to bury, you must not leave the body hanging on the pole overnight. Be sure to bury it that same day, because anyone who is hung on a pole is under God's curse. So everybody walking by Jesus being crucified would say, see, see, see? Despised by God, under God's curse. You must not desecrate the land the Lord your God is giving you as an inheritance. Jesus lived the opposite of the moral show. Just a little group, just a few people, thought he was something special, thought that maybe he was pointing them in the right direction. Now, if I had preached this prayer, this passage, as I had done in previous years, fasting was sort of a thing only known by serious Christians who would read certain passages in the Bible and say, ah, the key, I'm going to fast and that will really help me get what I want. And fair enough. But fasting, of all things, has become fashionable. Intermittent fasting, all sorts of fasts, is now popular over not too far away from here in the Bay Area with all the really smart people working as software engineers at Google and other places in the Bay Area. We as human beings, after thousands of years of feeding ourselves, really don't know what to eat. In the ancient world, when they said they didn't know what to eat, it meant they have nothing to eat. For us, we have everything to eat. We have more to eat than we know what to do with. We have all kinds of things to eat that really make us happy. And so now we've eaten too much of it, and so we must fast. But, as with everything else that people do in competition, suddenly we make fasting into a competition. Let's see who can lose the most weight. Let's see who can live the longest. Let's see who can have the healthiest body. And fasting seems to be a way of having those things for yourself. Was this what Jesus was talking about? Well, quite likely not. Fasting was a very ancient religious method of what was called self-mortification. When we were going through the book of 1 Peter, we talked a lot about epithumia, those sinful desires, those over-desires, those desires that we naturally have, but they begin to consume us and take possession of us. And again, the New Testament would say, put those things to death. Well, how do you do that? Well, you practice. Well, how do you practice? You deny yourself food. You deny yourself acclaim. You deny yourself status. You deny yourself sex. And you can see that fasting really isn't antithetical to the main point Jesus was trying to make in the three points he had listed below. We are very glandular creatures, and fasting trains seriously religious people to take a step back from their natural desires and practice self-control. But, as is always, when we do some things a little bit, well, if a little bit is good, maybe more is better. And so, as the religious traditions developed, well, spiritual athletes who could fast for long periods of time would perfect fasting and self-denial. They would live on top of poles. They would go out into the desert to fast. Now, in all fairness to these people, they were doing what's right. They didn't have to put on a long face. No one would see them. But yet, their reputation would go far and wide, and people would go out to the desert to see the truly spiritual athletes. They were seen as having power and authority. And again, if you're hanging around enough religious communities, you'll find these same dynamics happen today. These are people who are serious about their self-denial, unlike most of us who, boy, if we skip a meal, that's considered true sacrifice. Now, in the period of the Protestant Reformation, much of this was abandoned because it was seen as corrupt. And monasteries in which many of these spiritual people gathered, while the individuals had vows of poverty, the monasteries would still take donations, and some monasteries became fabulously wealthy. And so there was this sort of circle that kept going around where people would found more and more orders that would really try this time to keep the attention of all of the sort of normal people who love the inspiration of the truly spiritual away from them. So monasteries sometimes became incredibly wealthy and incredibly powerful. And it seems, as much as we try, we can't get away from these dynamics. Now, is this just about religious? Because most of the people that you know and go to work with and are married to and raise or have been raised by aren't any of those fasting spiritual athletes. There are some out there, and you might know who they are, but actually, we find this exact same dynamic in relationships, in institutions, in communities, and especially in Christianity and in cultures that Christianity has deeply impacted. Because Christianity created the value of the servant, the value of self-denial, and so what we wind up doing is competing in self-denial. I am doing all the work, and you're not. I am doing all the sacrifice, and you're not. I am doing all the mental work that is critical to making the world a better place. Why aren't you working as hard as I am? You can, in fact, probably rewind the tape on what high percentage of marital debates, family squabbles, squabbles with roommates, squabbles with coworkers. There's always the case that someone is doing all the work and a whole bunch of others are grifters and slackers not doing the work. And so those who do all the self-denial, who do all the work, who do all the giving, who do all the shouldering of the load that makes this world a better place, at some point get fed up and say, "Hey, I'm doing it all, you lazy slouch." And exactly the same dynamic that Jesus points to with respect to fasting gets visited there. So in a large degree of world maintaining, not even fixing, requires regular, unseen self-denial and sacrifice. Every parent does it. Every good spouse does it. Every good citizen does it. Every good member of almost any community does it. And again, and again, and again, it actually goes unseen. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? If you listen to Jesus, Jesus will say, "Your Father in heaven sees, and he will reward what you do in secret." But most of it will go unseen, and most of us will go to the grave if we are doing it or even think we're doing it, imagining ourselves the victim of a relationship or a circumstance or a bad set of luck. When people draw attention to themselves, however, for doing this thing, they almost always look petty. At the center of Christianity is a man who didn't lead a revolution, who didn't kill large numbers of people, who didn't write a best-selling book, who got no royalties for any of the things he said. In fact, when he was finally killed, he just had a few possessions, and only one item seemed worth enough to not necessarily tear into shreds and use for rags. At the center of the religion is the ultimate expression of self-denial. And when he was doing it, nobody understood what he was doing. Only after he was gone did it begin to dawn on people. The Apostle Paul in Romans 5 writes this: "You see, at the right time, when we were still powerless and clueless, Christ died for the ungodly." Very rarely will anyone die for a righteous person. Though for a good person, someone might possibly dare to die. But God demonstrates his own love for us. While we were still sinners, Christ died for us. If you go back and you look at chapter 5, the passage I pointed to last week, that very much mirrors these: don't give your money away in public, don't pray in public, don't fast in public, don't do these things for people to see. Well, your Heavenly Father sends rain, whether people thank him or not. Gives the Son, whether people thank him or not. Sends his own Son to die and be humiliated for sinners, and we didn't even notice. Well, where do you start? You start in the center. You start in the middle. You start knowing what has been done for you. Now, you might know it intellectually, but when we're feeling like the victim, when we're feeling like we've been taken advantage of, when we're feeling like we're making the great sacrifice and nobody sees us, well, then we tend to slip. And so that's why he gives us this meal. And he feeds us with himself. This is real spiritual drink and real spiritual food to strengthen you and to make you like him. So this is his body for you. And this is his blood for you. Go and do likewise for each other.